Hi, I'm Dan Barber from Blue Hill and Blue Hill at Stone Barns. You are listening to Food Fridays on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Psychologists tell us that having a family meal is really important, but at times they're really hard to pull off, especially when the cook gets home late from work. Which is why we've invited Jack Bishop, editorial director of America's Test Kitchen, back to our show. He's here to talk about which kitchen essentials you should have on hand to make whipping up that family dinner less traumatic. And it helps that America's Test Kitchen has just come out with the new family cookbook, from which we have three recipes, by the way, on our show page. Glad to have you back with us, Jack.
Great to be here.
Do you make your own family dinner on a regular basis?
I do. My wife and I take turns. We have two teenage daughters. And, the family meal is pretty much sacrosanct. 6:30, the four of us gather at the table and share a meal. And I think a lot of people worry about, making it more complex than it has to be. And it's most important to just do it. Even if it's not perfect, it's the habit is the most important thing about a family meal.
Well, in your case, of course, you've spent your whole day with food. I can imagine it gets a bit tiring. Do you have a go-to recipe or two that you make if you're tired and can't think of what else to make and you don't want to call for takeout?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of I alternate between obsessive planning, and that doesn't mean start planning at 5:30 or 6 o'clock. Usually, it means the night before or that morning, and then just absolutely winging it. I will wing it more probably in the summer because there are great things, herbs, and my pots that I can go to. There's probably better produce hanging out in my house from local farms, and more willing to wing it. The grill's out there, and when you can feel like you can grill, which is about maybe 9 months of the year, somehow or other it's easier to wing it than when, there are not a whole lot of things in the cupboard or in the refrigerator.
And one of the big problems sometimes is you want to make a recipe, and you realize, oh, I don't have buttermilk, or I don't have plain yogurt or cake flour or whatever. The inside cover of the book has emergency substitutions that I'm sure everybody's been faced with that at some time or another. You don't want to go out to the supermarket. It's getting late. And you do have something in the house that you don't realize would make a good substitution.
Yeah, I think those substitutions, because it's really, you don't want to make a horrible mistake and make a substitution that's going to ruin the recipe. I think the substitutions are really important whenever you're trying to do any baking, whether you're, making something simple like biscuits or cornbread or you're making a cake. You really want to make sure that your substitution is in order, that it's one that's been vetted. When it comes to savory food and when you're making dinner, I give myself more leeway. And I think you think about textures and cooking times. So if a recipe calls for one vegetable and you happen to have something else on hand, think about, are they similar enough that you can make a swap? Or if they're not similar, what do you need to do differently in terms of the cooking to be able to take a recipe that, calls for zucchini, but you're going to use butternut squash? Obviously, those are pretty different from each other. But if you think about the cooking properties, you can come up with some ideas about what you might need to change.
You have a bunch of tips at the beginning of the new family cookbook that took me by surprise, especially since some of them involve things I should have done in the past, like read the recipe carefully and then follow the instructions at least the first time you attempt a dish.
More bad results come from people getting halfway through the recipe and realizing that either, number one, the recipe is a two-hour recipe and it's 7 o'clock and the family is not going to be patient for two more hours. Realizing something has to marinate or something.
Yeah, brine it. Put it in the refrigerator, brine it, and then take it out, let it return to room temperature.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why every one of the recipes in the family cookbook, we also put the total time. So that for those of you who don't want to read the whole recipe, but at a glance want to know, is this a 30-minute recipe or a 3-hour recipe? But you still want to read the recipe, make sure you understand all the steps, you have all the equipment. You know, if you're going to need a sheet pan, well, do you have a sheet pan? And you don't want to figure that out halfway through the recipe. And I like to say to people, you know, the first time, make the recipe as it's written, and then start improvising and doing your own thing. I think as a professional, there's nothing more frustrating than somebody saying they didn't like a recipe, and then you realize they didn't actually make your recipe. They made someone else's recipe. They thought it was your recipe, but it's not really your recipe because they customized it so much that it's not really the original recipe.
Well, I guess you make it exactly the way it's written the first time to find out what it should be like, and then you can decide whether you want more of this or that. When you read a recipe as a professional, when you're reading it for the first time, are you already analyzing it to see what things are being done the way that they're being done?
Yeah, I mean, I think the two things I look for is, does the fundamental cooking technique seem sound? You know, something, you know, in any recipe that seems off, okay, you've got some tender piece of meat and it's telling you to, you know, braise it. Well, that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. You know, you want fatty cuts that can really withstand hours in a pot if you're talking about making a pot roast or a braising. So it's like, are the fundamental techniques in place? And then for me, I'm a sucker for really interesting combinations of ingredients. And it's like, oh, I never thought of putting those two things together. And that's what that's what draws me to a recipe and gets me to choose that recipe as something I want to make, because those are flavors I like and I hadn't thought about putting them together before.
By the way, if members of our audience have tips for making a weeknight meal quicker, more efficient, or if you have a question for Jack Bishop, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692, write to us on our show page at WNYC.org, or if you need an immediate response, our Twitter handle is at Leonard Lopate. Another tip you have is to preheat an oven. People don't do that?
You know, a lot of people, it's not the first thing they do. And so, you know, if you're going to need a hot oven, let's say you need a 450-degree oven, because a lot of weeknight cooking, one of the ways to speed it up is to use more heat. And if you're using the oven, that means a hot oven. Turn the oven on first thing so that when you're ready to put the food in the oven and you've got it all prepped, your oven is ready to go. And it seems really basic, but, you know, we find that cooking skills are all over the place now. From people who really know how to read a recipe backwards, forwards, and other people who are really just starting out in the kitchen and need basic information, like make sure to preheat the oven before you put the roast in.
And then you say we shouldn't prepare garlic and onions in advance. Does chopping them up a couple of hours before do something negative to them?
Yeah, I mean, think about an onion at the supermarket. It has no real aroma whatsoever. And when you go to chop that onion, and the same thing applies to garlic, you are changing the cellular structure and causing an enzymatic reaction that develops the flavor. But that enzymatic reaction keeps going until the onion or the garlic is heated. And so that onion gets just more and more pungent. And so if you chop that onion and I see people putting it in the refrigerator and then come back and use it 2 days later, that is going to be a very, very strong onion when you go to cook it. And, you know, unless that's something you want, onions and garlic are things to, you know, prep at the last minute. Obviously, other vegetables, bell peppers, zucchini, cucumbers, tomatoes, this all can be prepped many hours in advance if you've got, you know, the ability to sort of break up the cooking for dinner. And if you're somebody who's working at home and want to take a, you know, 10-minute break at 3 o'clock, go ahead and deal with that kind of prep. But leave the onions and garlic until you're actually ready to cook.
You say it's bad to seed tomatoes. Don't many recipes call for that?
Believe it or not, most of the flavor in a tomato is in what I call the jelly. That kind of viscous liquid that surrounds the seeds, and that when you discard the seeds, you throw out the jelly, and that has the best flavor, not the skin, not the flesh, but that jelly. And yes, there's some recipes for aesthetic reasons where it might be a good idea to seed the tomatoes, but there are very few of them. And a lot of recipes that call for seeding the tomatoes, like if you're making a basic pasta sauce, it's just a wasted time. And you're going to end up with a sauce that has less tomato flavor.
You say it's important to start cooking when the pan is hot. How do you tell? Do you turn on the heat before you add the oil or the butter?
I like to heat the oil with the pan because the oil is the best gauge of the temperature of that pan. And so the two ways to sort of think about it are that the oil will start to shimmer, and you can sort of see it moving around. And that's what I would call sort of a medium-hot pan, probably good for vegetables, something that, you know, you're not trying to sear. The next stage is if the oil continues to heat, it goes from shimmering to you begin to see the first wisp of smoke. At that point, that's the temperature you want if you're searing a piece of meat or a piece of fish, that you know that the oil is at the right temperature. And the problem is for people who heat the pan and then put the oil in, you know, they don't really have quite a good gauge about whether or not the pan is hot enough. Sometimes they'll put their hand over the pan. I just put the oil in the cold pan, turn the heat on, and then just look for those clues, whether it's either shimmering or just beginning to smoke.
Now, Nora Ephron once wrote a recipe, obviously a joke, in which she said, heat the Teflon pan until you see a mist of carcinogens rise from the pan. Do you like Teflon?
For certain things, I mean, if you're cooking eggs, it's great, but that's a good reason to put the oil in, is that if you overheat the Teflon pan, it can actually give off some fumes that can cause a flu-like symptoms in humans and can actually be very dangerous to small animals like birds, if you keep birds in your kitchen, which is actually not a great idea. And one reason to always heat the oil with the pan is if you're using a nonstick, that oil is going to be, you know, really smoking way before the pan gets dangerously hot and is your clue that, oh, my heavens, I've left that pan on and it's gotten too hot. I need to take it off the heat.
You also say never discard the fond. What's the fond?
So if you're browning something, and this can be anything from a chicken cutlet to mushrooms in a hot pan, when you're finished browning the food, you'll notice that there are little bits of caramelized brown proteins that are clinging to the bottom of that pan. And if you're making a pan sauce, for instance, those are the sort of liquid gold. You know, they're going to turn into all of the flavor. And so if you're making, for instance, chicken breasts, you would take them out of the pan when they're browned. And then you want to deglaze the pan. You'll add some liquid stock, wine, and scrape up those brown bits, and they'll dissolve back into the pan sauce and give that sauce a tremendous meaty flavor. And so don't wash that pan. You're basically throwing out a lot of flavor. You want to make a sauce from that. Or if you're adding, if you're browning mushrooms, you want to add some liquid once they're browned and scrape up any of those browned bits so that they get incorporated back into the food.
We are putting a number of the recipes from the book on our website. And one of them is weeknight roast chicken, which you roast in a preheated skillet?
Yeah, this is a really interesting recipe. You know, a lot of magazines and cookbooks, ours included, have all of these ultimate recipes for roast chicken. And generally they involve either salting or brining the chicken. But, you know, what if you want to make a roast chicken on a Tuesday night after work and you really don't want to be doing anything other than getting it out of the package and into the pan? What's the secret? And we found a really unusual recipe that relies on jump-starting the process by roasting it in a skillet that starts on the stove and then moves to the oven. And then we turn the heat off in the oven halfway through, because, of course, the big challenge whenever you're roasting a chicken is that the white meat is going to dry out and you're going to overcook the bird. And by turning off the oven heat for that last part, it's very gentle heat. You don't open the oven door. You leave the skillet with the chicken in there. And
are you talking about a cast iron skillet?
It can be a conventional, you know, stainless steel skillet. You would not want to use nonstick here, but it could be cast iron if you have cast iron. But, you know, if you have all-clad or Calflon, any sort of traditional finish, you can go ahead and use that. And then the residual heat gently brings the temperature of the chicken up to the correct internal temperature. And, you know, you've sort of increased the window for getting that chicken perfectly cooked because the oven temperature is is obviously by the time you get to the end of the 30 minutes with the oven turned off, is really pretty gentle. And it's a really interesting way of shielding the breast, because the breast is facing up, jump-starting the legs, because they're facing down, and so they get more of that heat on the stovetop. And then everything moves into the oven where the heat is more even, and you get a perfectly cooked roast chicken in a little over an hour.
My guest is Jack Bishop, editorial director of America's Test Kitchen. They have a new cookbook out called The New Family Cookbook, all new edition of the best-selling classic with 1,100 new recipes, including the one we were just talking about. Actually, that's not on our website, but we do have recipes for oven-baked buffalo wings, pumpkin bread, and skillet apple crisp. You can find those on our show page at WNYC.org. And you can also write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. If you want to communicate with Jack Bishop, you can call us at 212-433-9692 or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And we'll take a little break and come back with more. Stay with us. We are back with Jack Bishop, editorial director at America's Test Kitchen. We're talking about the latest release from that group, The New Family Cookbook, all new edition, the best-selling classic with 1,100 new recipes, and inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And let's go to a couple of calls. Catherine, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I was. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to call and share how I personally prepare for family meals. Basically, we're vegetarian, so we have to do a lot of preparing that involves also weekly shopping, because vegetables are in season at certain times and not in others. So I always make sure to keep in mind what's in season. I do my meal planning every Sunday morning and then shop at the farmer's market that day. I make two lists. I make one shopping list, and then I make my meal plan list. And I also always include what cookbook I'm using and what page number so that I can refer to it more easily. And then every morning, I prepare all my ingredients. I put them in little prep bowls with lids, stick them in the fridge so that I know. And then if there's an instruction like bake 450, I put a little post-it note on it so that I know how long it needs to go in for. And sometimes when I know it's going to be a really busy night, I make the whole casserole in advance and just pop it in the oven. The other tip I have is to do leftovers once a week.
Jack, she sounds very prepared.
Catherine is ready. The people in her family are very lucky, is all I can say.
Thank you.
But Catherine, I have just one question. Since you're buying all your vegetables at the farmer's market on Sunday, what's happening on Friday when some of those vegetables have started to wilt? Do you also plan to use the vegetables that you need to use right away in the early meals and then put off the beets until later in the week?
I do, actually. And I'm also part of a local CSA, Community Supported Agriculture Group, so we get a box of vegetables, not of our choosing, but definitely local and delicious every Thursday. And so my kind of Friday through Monday meal plan, it includes those vegetables.
Thank you so much for calling us, Catherine. Some of the other tips you have, some that I'd never thought about, is when to incorporate herbs. Is it different when they're fresh and when they're dried?
Yes, and it's also different depending on what the herb is. So the fresh versus dried, dried herbs always need to go into a recipe fairly early in the process. So if you're making a sauce or a stew or soup, you want to give them some time to hydrate, and that you don't want to finish with a dried herb. Fresh herbs, on the other hand, are great for finishing and basically tossing at the very end with salt and pepper, maybe a little bit of lemon juice or some acidity. Now, within the world of fresh herbs, there's some that really never should see much heat, like basil is a pretty good example, where it's really much better at the very end of the cooking process. So anything that's really delicate, parsley is another one that's really much better at it at the end. The heartier fresh herbs, so oregano would be a good example, those can see more heat and will withstand a longer cooking process than something like basil, which really shouldn't be cooked all that much.
And in the book on the back cover, you have conversions, including how much the difference between using a fresh herb and using a dried herb. I was fascinated by the fact that when you're doing a cup of flour, when you're converting them to ounces, it's different with all-purpose flour, cake flour, whole wheat flour. You can go anywhere from, 5.5 to 4 ounces on those things. And then sugar is a cup of granulated sugar or brown sugar is 7 ounces.
This is why professional bakers always weigh, because the size of the particles, whether you're talking about flour or sugar, greatly impacts the way it will, measure out in a dry measuring cup. And even if you're really careful, odds are you probably have a 10 to 20% variability based on the person who's actually doing the measuring. How forceful are they when they're dipping the cup into the canister of sugar, for instance, or flour? And so that's why when you weigh, you know that 7 ounces is 7 ounces, assuming that your scale is accurate.
And I'm never sure what firmly packed means.
No, nobody is. I mean, you're one man's firmly packed is another man's loosely packed. Mm-hmm. And so that is why all of the baking recipes, we give both the volume measure, 1 cup, 2 cup, and then we always give an ounce conversion for those key ingredients like the brown sugar, the granulated sugar, the flour, because we really would prefer that people would weigh, but we know that some people don't have a scale or don't want to get out the scale.
Let's take another call. This one is from Susan from Trenton, New Jersey. Hi, Susan.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm well.
Hi, Jack. Thank you so much for the wonderful show today. I appreciate it. Jack, I'm calling because I have a question for you on slow cookers. My schedule was such that I often got home between 7 and 7:30, which made the prospect of cooking a meal kind of difficult, not to mention the fact that I was usually, we were starving. So waiting another hour or so was not practical. But when it came to slow cookers, it seemed like it was so much work to get things prepared in the morning before leaving for work. And also, sometimes the meat was incredibly mushy. And I don't know if I was doing something wrong or if there's a good technique. But I'd like your reactions to the idea of a slow cooker as an alternative sometimes for cooking a meal at the end of the day.
Yes, Susan, a slow cooker can be a great alternative, but a couple of things. One is you want a slow cooker that automatically goes to keep warm mode. So that if you program in, let's say, 8 hours, that will turn itself over to keep warm at that 8-hour mark rather than just keep on going. Because, of course, if you're an hour or two late, the food keeps on cooking, which can sometimes lead to mushy results. So that's one thing. Second thing is to make sure you're choosing recipes carefully. Some foods do much better with long times in a slow cooker. Chicken is one that doesn't do well, for instance. It just dries out, and it's fine in the slow cooker for 4, 5, 6 hours, but not for 9 hours, for instance. And then in terms of the prep, one tip is a lot of recipes call for pre-cooking onions, garlic, spices. You can do all of that in the microwave. So we'll toss all of those aromatics in a little bowl with some oil and then microwave them until they're softened 4 or 5 minutes and fragrant. And that really develops all the flavors of those ingredients, but you don't have to get the skillet out at 7:30 in the morning while you're trying to, figure out what you're going to have for breakfast. And you can even prep get as much prep done the night before as you can, and make sure you're looking for recipes that's as much adding it directly to the slow cooker and literally turning it on.
Okay.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Kiss my mushy chicken goodbye. Thank you.
Jack Bishop is our guest. He's the editorial director at America's Test Kitchen. We're talking about, cooking in general, but also America's Test Kitchen has just released the new family cookbook, a huge book, one of those doorstop type books with 1,100 new recipes in it. We're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. I'm always told that one of the most important things to have is a good knife. But even with good knives, they need sharpening. Do you recommend getting one of those electric knife sharpeners?
Yes, because the reality is that most home cooks, myself included, don't do a very good job of sharpening it by the other tools. You know, with a whetstone is the classic way of doing it. I mean, that steel that came with the knife set you got when you were married and it was a part of your wedding registry, that is not a sharpener. That's really just meant to correct an edge that's just a teeny bit dull. But when a knife is really dull, you need to sharpen it.
I always thought that those things were there for kids to play with when making believe that they're doing a sword fight.
That's basically what they're there for. Technically, they're there if there's a little teeny burr on a sharp knife at the edge, that the steel will take that burr off and restore an edge that's basically sharp except for in one or two spots. But when the entire edge is dull, which happens very quickly, if you cook often, you probably need to be sharpening your knives every couple of weeks and steeling it in between. An electric knife sharpener is really the most foolproof way of doing it, and it's a really pretty great investment. I mean, rather than buying extra knives, I tell people to get three or four good knives, a paring knife, a slicing knife, a chef's knife, of course, and then spend the money on the electric knife sharpener.
Now, what about cutting boards? Do you prefer plastic or wood, or is one good for one thing and the other for something else?
Well, as long as you avoid glass, which is absolutely an abomination, it will ruin your knives, and it will make awful noises in your kitchen. It doesn't really matter whether you use plastic or wood. Probably the biggest thing to think about is how you want to clean the board. And if you're somebody who wants to be able to throw the board in the dishwasher, obviously you want to be getting plastic and make sure that you're getting boards that will fit in your dishwasher. If you're somebody that doesn't mind getting the hot, soapy water out, you know, wood is gorgeous, it's lovely, not that hard to take care of. You just need to dry it afterwards. And we actually ran some tests in terms of getting them clean, bacteria counts. Wood, plastic is pretty much the same as long as you use a hot dishwasher or hot soapy water in the sink. Just pick the one that you know that you're going to clean properly.
A caller from New Jersey asked you for a suggestion for breakfast other than cereal. And also wonders, I don't know if it's a man or a woman, whether people should rinse meat before they cook it.
Never, ever, ever rinse meat before
you're washing out the blood, aren't you?
No, we ran tests. We took meat and poultry that we washed and didn't wash, cooked them. Nobody could tell the difference between them. And what you are doing when you are rinsing poultry or meat is you are spreading that bacteria around your sink, which, believe it or not, there's more bacteria in your sink than your garbage can. And there doesn't need to be any more bacteria in your sink. And so, it's just asking for problems, because the next thing you do is you put some vegetables in there or something, your sponge is in there, and it's just not a great idea. And there's no benefit to it. Maybe 100 years ago, the poultry and the meat that we bought was in such condition that it benefited from rinsing. But what we get today at the supermarket does not need to be rinsed.
You add a totally surprising ingredient to your foolproof pie dough.
Vodka. The challenge with pie dough is you want to add as little moisture as possible, because the water, when it mixes with the flour, forms gluten. And the more gluten that develops, the tougher the crust. And so if you want a really flaky crust, you want to add as little water as possible. But the problem is, when you add very little water, you then have a dough that's very difficult to roll out, and it cracks, and it's not very friendly to the baker. And so people end up adding more water than they should. And so when we were developing this recipe in the test kitchen, we said, well, what could we add that would moisten the flour and make the pie dough easier to roll out, but that wouldn't develop gluten? And it turns out that alcohol, when it mixes with the flour, doesn't activate the gluten, which is what makes a tough pie dough. But it does moisten the flour so that it rolls out nicely. So we use a mixture of both chilled vodka and ice water. And the vodka cooks off in the oven. Can't taste it. You can use tequila if you want. Doesn't really make a difference what you're using as long as you're using something that's 40 proof. And it really is the secret to a dough that's easy to handle and super flaky and very tender.
We put three recipes from the cookbook on our show page at WNYC.org, oven-baked buffalo wings, pumpkin bread, and skillet apple crisp. The skillet because that keeps the apple crisp from getting mushy?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really great way of starting the apples on the stovetop to cook them quickly, and you can turn them so they cook evenly. You know, a lot of times if you just throw the apples in the oven, they take a very long time to soften, and they kind of get dried out and leathery. So this speeds up the process, and then once the apples are partially cooked, you put the topping on the apples and then put it in a very hot oven to just basically crisp up the brown sugar butter topping. And so it's a faster way of doing it and a better way of doing it.
And for the pumpkin bread recipe, you use canned pumpkin puree, but doesn't that often give a kind of metallic flavor?
Yes, and so we always say that you're better off using canned pumpkin, whether you're making a pumpkin bread or a pumpkin pie filling. But you want to cook it first, and you're doing a couple things. First of all, you're cooking out that tinny flavor. You also are concentrating its flavor. So if you cook it with the spices, some of the water is coming out of it so that you get a firmer filling if you're talking about a pumpkin pie. You get a sort of less soggy result if you're adding that canned pumpkin to a pumpkin bread. And the thing is that most pumpkins that you would buy at a farmer's market, the amount of work that it would take does not yield a better result in terms of using that pumpkin puree in something like a bread or a pie filling, and that the canned pumpkin is totally fine as long as you cook it in a saucepan for 5 or 10 minutes with the spices, maybe some of the other ingredients, depending on the recipe.
Jack, thank you so much for being on our show again. Jack Bishop is the editorial director at America's Test Kitchen. We have taken three recipes from their latest cookbook, The New Family Cookbook, which has 1,100 new recipes, plus some older ones. And we have them on our show page, oven-baked buffalo wings, pumpkin bread, and skillet apple crisp. Jack, it's always fun to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Leonard.